Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I'm a resident. This is episode 209 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. In this podcast, I'm going to be continuing the Family Medicine Shelf Review. This is going to be part two. And really, in this podcast, I'm going to be going over the psychiatry that's tested on the Family Medicine Shelf. Okay, so think of this as a Family Medicine Shelf Review Psych Edition, basically, right? And I know some of you may be saying psych on the Family Medicine Shelf. Well, again, trust me, I've tutored people for these exams, right? So I kind of know what I'm talking about here. There is a fairly decent number of psych questions on the shelf. Really, if you understand what I talk about in this podcast, you should be pretty much set from the psych perspective on your Family Medicine Shelf. So I'm just going to jump right into it. I'm going to talk about like 8 or 9 different topics and then we'll be done. And obviously, I'm going to talk about it with a family medicine perspective, right? Not necessarily with a psychiatry perspective, if you may. So the first topic I'll talk about, obviously, is going to be depression, right? So major depressive disorder. And again, the MBMA will not write the question where they want you to think about the psychiatric diagnosis and not give you some kind of hint that you should think along those lines on the test, right? So the thing is depression, right? Like, you know, they may give you like a screening related question on your exam and then ask you to pick the best statement that helps you screen a person for depression, right? Basically, the questions you use in family medicine, you just ask the patient, over the past 2 weeks, have you felt down? Have you felt depressed? Have you felt hopeless, right? Or you can say, over the past 2 weeks, have you felt like little interest, or have you had little pleasure in doing things? Basically, if the person says yes to any of these things, right? So, okay, I guess maybe let me say these questions again, right? So, over the past 2 weeks, have you felt down, depressed, or hopeless, right? Or you can say, over the past 2 weeks, have you felt little interest or pleasure in doing things? Again, if the patient says yes to any of these things, you need to kind of screen them, sort of go down the diagnostic pathway for depression. The thing is, it's actually kind of high yield to know that just in general, in internal family medicine in general, there's this love for what I call gateway questions. You ask the gateway question. If the person is positive, because again, you don't have like copious amounts of time to spend with patients, right? So if a person is screens positive with a gateway question, you then go down like the big rabbit hole, right? But if the person doesn't screen positive, then you don't need to go down the rabbit hole, right? So if the person answers yes to any of these questions, then you need to then apply CE CAPS to those people, right? And remember, CE CAPS is 8 letters, right? So that means there must be a 9th thing that's included, right? And basically, right, so what does CE CAPS stand for, right? So the S is for sleep, right? The I is for loss of interest. The G is for guilt, right? The E is for low energy, right? Many times they put fatigue as low energy on MBMA exams. And then concentration is the C. A is the appetite. P is like the psychomotor retardation, right? And then the S is suicidality. And then the 9th thing, right, is like low mood or anhedonia, right? So basically, if the person has 5 or more, so if they have at least 5 of these 9 symptoms for 2 or more weeks, right, they have a major depressive disorder, right? And the thing is, obviously, major depressive disorder, there are certain treatments which I'll talk about in a second. But if a person, right, you know, is like in danger of like harming themselves or harming other people imminently, you need to hospitalize the patient, even if it's against their kind of like desires, right? So you can hospitalize them. And if a person has like, you know, like major depressive disorder and they have like psychotic features, right, or you know, they have like a suicide plan and stuff like that, you do need to refer them to psychiatry on an MBMA exam, okay? Like, you know, maybe you can hold them against their will in the hospital, but you need to consult psychiatry to treat the patient, right? That's kind of like beyond the purview of family medicine practice. And the thing is, if, for example, the MBMA gives you a question about a person that has like depressive-like symptoms, but they tell you that they kind of describe symptoms either like in the present moment in the question or like in the past, that, you know, the person had like manic symptoms, then you want to go ahead and make the diagnosis of bipolar disorder under those circumstances, right? So again, bipolar disorder is just basically a person having like mania, right? And then they have depressive episodes as well, right? I mean, it's called bipolar. Bipolar, the word bi means two, polar means two poles, right? So it's like you have elevated mood at one point and then you have very depressed mood at the other point, right? And then there are some other like depression related disorders you want to be able to recognize for your exam, right? So like there's this one called like seasonal affective disorder you may see on your test, right? It's basically like a subtype of like depression. And for the most part, those people tend to have like the onset of symptoms, like, you know, during like the fall or the winter. And then like when the season abates, their symptoms symptoms go away as well, right? For the most part, you treat seasonal affective disorder with SSRIs and phototherapy. I'll say that again. Seasonal affective disorder is treated with SSRIs and phototherapy, right? And then a major depressive disorder-like condition that's not really a major depressive disorder is just like, you know, like a grief kind of reaction, right? So they'll talk about a person that actually died, right? And, you know, the person may have like depression-style symptoms for like a transient period of time. But really, I'll say like a normal grief reaction usually on MBA means is the person will just be sad, right? And their thoughts will focus around the person that died, right? If the person starts having like psychosis or hears someone speaking to them, like someone that like not the dead person essentially, like some other brother in some other state or country or whatever speaking to them in their dreams or whatever, that's psychosis, right? That's psychosis, right? And if the person is like completely beat down, like, you know, like almost like they're like in bed for days and days and days and on end doing nothing, and they have like just really super bad guilt about the whole event, right? That's not a normal grief reaction, right? That's not a normal grief reaction. You don't need to kind of like keep tabs on that on an exam, right? And then another depression-related disorder is like a pre-menstrual dysphoric disorder, right? Like PMDD, some people call it PMS. Although PMDD is like a more severe form of PMS, essentially, right? But basically, right, these people will have like depressive-style symptoms or anxiety-style symptoms. And, you know, they'll kind of be emotionally all over the place. And typically starts about 1 week before they start having menses, and the symptoms go away like 1 week after menses end. Typically for these people, you get like a symptom diary, right? So that's actually the best way to make the diagnosis. You give them a symptom diary, they kind of check off boxes, and then you have them come back into the office, and then you can formally make the diagnosis and begin to proceed towards treatment. And then for your family medicine shelf, just kind of be careful, right? Sometimes some people can have like substance abuse issues, and it may present as depression, or they may be hypothyroid. Remember, typically when a person has depression, right, you want to go ahead and, you know, just check their TSH to make sure they're not hypothyroid. Or if a person has Cushing's syndrome, again, remember, steroids can make a person's brain go wacko, right? So, you know, you kind of want to be careful with that. Or people that just recently had like a stroke, or a person that has Parkinson's, those people can have depression as a presentation, right? And then don't forget, again, if a person is taking corticosteroids, especially like IV corticosteroids, right, for like an exacerbation of some kind of rheumatologic disorder or autoimmune disorder, those things can trigger depression. And also the drug interferon, right? So they can give you a patient with hep C that recently started treatment and then has like depressive style symptoms. If you see that, you absolutely want to think about like depression secondary to like a substance or something like that. Okay, and again, they will usually give you hints in the question that will tell you to maybe go ahead and do some kind of diagnostic testing for these other disorders, right? And in general, again, depression, you probably want to go ahead and start with an SSRI, right, on an MBM exam. Although occasionally they may give you like some patient specific factors or like some side effects that may lead you to go with one versus the other. Right. So, for example, like if a person has, you know, like a history of like really bad like cardiac disease, like they have a history of like CHF or like really bad hypertension and all that stuff, sertraline is actually a pretty good drug for those people. Right. So if a person has like, you know, really bad cardiovascular disease, sertraline is probably the answer you want to go ahead with on your exam. Right. And obviously, right, if a person has like any kind of sexual dysfunction or they don't want to gain weight, they maybe want to lose weight or they want to quit smoking, bupropion is not a terrible choice for those people. Right? Remember, bupropion is a norepinephrine dopamine reuptake inhibitor, right? So, you know, it has fewer sexual side effects, doesn't cause weight gain, helps with smoking cessation, right? Although remember, you don't want to give bupropion, right, to people that have like bulimia or any of those things, because they can have electrolyte imbalances that can set them up for seizures, because bupropion lowers the seizure threshold, right? And then if remember that this drug mirtazapine, remember mirtazapine is actually an alpha-2 antagonist. If you remember from studying for step one, the alpha-2 receptor is a G protein coupled receptor. It's an inhibitory G protein coupled receptor. So when you activate it, right, that decreases the release of catecholamines. But if you inhibit it, you will increase the release of catecholamine. So it's good in that setting, right? But remember that it's actually it actually causes like sedation and weight gain, right? So if a person has like major depressive disorder, right, and they have like concomitant insomnia or they have weight loss, then mirtazapine is an excellent drug on MBM exams for those people. And then there is this antidepressant known as people call it Paxil in the hospital, but it's paroxetine. That's the name you'll see on an MBM exam. You actually do not want to give it to a pregnant woman. That it's actually like pregnancy category D. So if a woman is pregnant, giving paroxetine is not an awesome idea. Basically, you'll get the question wrong if you did that on an MBM exam, right? And the thing is, if, for example, you have a patient that, you know, has been placed on an antidepressant and for like 6 to 8 weeks, they don't appear to be responding, essentially your treatment options on an MBM exam is you can either increase the dose of the antidepressant they're on, like titrate it to the maximum dose, or you can switch them to a different antidepressant, or you can switch them to another class of anti. So you can switch from one anti-SSRI to another SSRI, or you can switch to a completely different drug class, like switching from like an SSRI to an SNRI. Right? And the thing is, one common question that pops up from students all the time, again, I tutor a ton of people, right? So they may say, oh, Divine, how do I treat like a person's like first episode of depression? The thing is, if a person is having depression for the first time, you know, you go ahead and start them on an antidepressant. And, you know, basically, like when you get to a dose that, you know, helps them kind of like have their symptoms go away, right? You kind of keep them on that dose for like, you know, like 4 to 9 months roughly, and they should be fine. But if a person, after that first episode of depression, then has another recurrence of depression, right? The thing is, so say for example, let me give you a treatment principle. Let's say a person has depression the first time. You treat them for like 4 to 9 months, as I've talked about. And then let's say their depression goes away even after they stop the drug, right? Let's say their depression goes away for like 6 months. And then boom, they have a like another recurrence. The smart thing to typically do on an MBM exam is when you're treating them the second time, right? Again, if you notice, I may be saying like some weird things, maybe like, Divine, stuff's kind of weird. The thing is, the family medicine shelf, as you probably have heard, is kind of a weird shelf, right? So unfortunately, some of these bizarre things I feel the need to kind of talk about, right? Again, just my experience having like tutored and taught a ton of people, right? So the thing is, if a person has like their second recurrence of depression, like basically take their depression free interval after like their initial medication was stopped, right? And then double it, and that should be the length of time that you treat them for, right? So again, if for example a person like after the first episode they got treated for 4 to 9 months and they didn't have symptoms for like 6 months, right? And then the depression comes back, you want to treat them for like 6 to 12 months essentially, right? Almost like double the time where they didn't have depressive symptoms. But here's another high yield thing to know. If a person has depression, right, and you know they get treated and the treatment is successful, but within less than a year after like they stop treatment, their symptoms come back, typically you want to go ahead and treat those people for life essentially with an antidepressant. Another key rule there is, if a person has like multiple like recurrences of depression, let's say like 3 or more, basically if a person has like 3 or more recurrences of depression, they also need to be placed on lifetime antidepressant therapy, right? So again, let me repeat that part because I feel like I may not have been very clear. Let's say a person comes in with depression, right? You treat them for 4 to 9 months, you stop their medication. After you stop their medication, if within less than a year their symptoms come back, those people need to be placed on lifelong antidepressant therapy. Alternatively, if a person has had like 3 or more recurrences of depression, they also need to be placed on lifetime antidepressant therapy, right? And then don't forget this serotonin syndrome, right? Like again, especially people that are being treated for depression, right? So people taking like SSRIs, and maybe they are taking other SSRIs, or you know, like MAOIs. In fact, they may make this a question where a person is taking an SSRI, they stop it, and then like 2-3 days later they start an MAOI. Those people are going to get serotonin syndrome, right? Remember, you usually need to wait for about 2 weeks for the SSRI to wash out before you start like any other like an MAOI or TCA, so they don't get serotonin syndrome, right? So again, don't forget your serotonergic agents, right? So your SSRIs, your MAOIs, right? Even a person that has Parkinson's, the MAOB inhibitors, right? Selegiline, rasagiline. Don't forget St. John's wort, right? So if a person is taking like a herbal supplement on your exam, right? If a person is taking like trazodone or dextromethorphan or linezolid, or remember linezolid is a 50S inhibitor. If you remember that from step one, you use it to treat like VRE and MRSA, but it also has weak monoamine oxidase inhibitor properties. So, you know, it can kind of cause problems, right? The dextromethorphan, right? So if a person is being treated on an SSRI and then they are taking like some kind of cough syrup. Remember, many cough syrups end in DM. The DM literally stands for dextromethorphan. That can trigger serotonin syndrome, right? Or tramadol, right? Again, a person taking like a pain medication, Tritran or Buspirone. Remember, Buspirone is used to treat generalized anxiety disorder. It's a partial agonist of serotonin receptors, right? Or if a person even has like a history of migraines, right? Migraines. Like your triptans, your sumatriptan, those are serotonergic agents, right? Or if a person is getting ergonovine, right? For like postpartum bleeding or whatever, right? Those things can all trigger serotonin syndrome. Those are all high yield things to know, right? And how does serotonin syndrome present? For the most part, those people will be, you know, they'll have like nausea, vomiting, they'll be flushing, they'll have diaphoresis, they'll have like increased deep tendon reflexes, they'll have myoclonus. Myoclonus is a classic thing that shows up on exams. They can occasionally also have muscle rigidity and hyperthermia, right? But watch out for like that myoclonus, the hyperreflexia and all that stuff, right? And again, before you start a person on an antidepressant, just make sure they've not had a manic episode, because typically an antidepressant can precipitate mania in a person that has a history of bipolar disorder, right? And again, when you're stopping an antidepressant, you don't just stop it like, oh, you just say, oh, stop your medication this morning. No, don't do that. That's not prudent, right? You need to taper their medication down over time, right? And again, if a person is going through a grief reaction, you typically do not need to treat with any kind of a drug or anything of that sort. Okay, right? And then bipolar disorder, I've kind of talked about it, right? Again, these people will have like manic. The thing is, if you notice, I'm not super particular about criteria. That's more for your psych shelf, but... Sorry, I don't know what's wrong with my throat this morning. But the major thing to keep in mind is you just want to make sure that you're able to recognize these disorders, right? So, like, mania, how mania presents on your exam, right? The person will have, like, you know, like an elevated mood. Basically, they'll feel like they're on top of the world, right? They may be having sex at more than normal rates, right? Or they can go, like, on a credit card spending spree. Or they feel like they are over the world, you know, kind of having, like, these grandiose thoughts. They don't sleep much. Maybe they are getting only 2 hours of sleep a night. You know, those are all things, and typically would disrupt their social and occupational functioning. Those are all things that tell you that a person has a mania, right? Although don't confuse mania on your exam with like a person going through like thyroid storm, or a person having like lupus, or again, a person having like, really steroids can really mess up a person's mind. Like a person taking corticosteroids can go super manic, right? So again, those are just all things you want to subtly watch out for on your exam, right? And for the most part, if a person has bipolar disorder, pretty much what you want to go ahead and do is, you know, go ahead and put them on a mood stabilizer like lithium. You know, lithium is kind of like a big one. Don't forget your lithium side effects, right? So remember, lithium can cause like nephrogenic diabetes insipidus. It can cause renal dysfunction, right? So the nephrogenic DI, right? So the person will be like volume down, right? You'll have hypernatremia. They'll have low urine osmolality, right? And remember, the lithium-induced nephrogenic DI, you treat it with like amiloride or triamterene, because they'll block that ENaC channel at the level of the principal cell of the collecting duct that lithium uses to gain access to the principal cell to cause issues and scrub the signaling cascade of antidiuretic hormone, right? And remember, lithium can also cause hypothyroidism, right? So that's something to watch out for. And the thing is, occasionally, on NBME exams, if a person is experiencing like all these like, you know, like bad lithium effects, one thing you can actually consider doing is to consider giving those people like some kind of anti-epileptic drug, right? So sometimes, believe it or not, you can give valproic acid for bipolar disorder. Again, careful in a person that's, you know, trying to get pregnant or at risk of becoming pregnant, or a person that has liver disease, they shouldn't be on valproic acid, right? And also the second generation antipsychotics, actually pretty good for bipolar disorder and NBME exams as well, right? In fact, you can actually use those as first line in place of lithium, right? Again, the NBME will kind of like set you up for like situations where either lithium is not an answer choice, or a person is experiencing toxicities of lithium, or a person has like chronic kidney disease to where it will not be prudent to give them lithium in the first place, right? So again, don't forget, SSRIs can, that's why, again, before you start a person on an antidepressant, you need to just quiz them about like manic symptoms so that you don't trigger mania in those people, right? So again, those are just things to keep in mind. And then the next topic I'll talk about, generalized anxiety disorder. Basically, these people are just anxious about many things. It's not just one thing. You know, they'll be anxious about many areas of their lives, how they'll pay school fees, how they'll do this, how they'll do that, how they'll pass the exams. And, you know, they'll typically be like restless. They won't be able to concentrate. They'll be like very irritable. Those people are like a light fuse, right? And they may even have disturbances of sleep with all these symptoms, right? And typically, when people have generalized anxiety disorder, actually, having generalized anxiety disorder is like a risk factor for having like a comorbid psychiatric disorder. And for the most part, you know, you can treat GAD with like I mean, obviously, you can treat them with, most psych disorders are amenable to CBT, but typically, your friends at the NBMA want you to go with like a drug, right? So you can give them like an SSRI, you can give them like an SNRI, right? And you can also give buspirone, right? Buspirone is like a partial agonist at serotonin, 5-HT, like serotonin receptors, right? So again, that's something to kind of watch out for. And again, if a person has a history of like really bad substance abuse, it's probably not a prudent idea to put them on a benzodiazepine, right? And one thing I will say is if a person is anxious over something that they frequently encounter, let's say they are super anxious when they get into like an MRI scanner or something like that, you don't need to put them on long-term therapy. You can just give them like a one-time dose of a benzo for that event, right? Or if a person needs to fly, again, you can give them a one-time benzo for that event, right? That's not a contraindication under those circumstances, because it's not like you're going to be in an MRI scanner every day of your life, right? So just, you know, kind of like a nice side story you want to keep in mind for your exams, right? And then another theme you see on your test is like social anxiety disorder. Basically, these people kind of have like this fear, or whenever they're like in a social situation or a situation where they have to perform, right? So they may have like symptoms, like they may be like blushing, they may be short of breath, or they may, you know, just feel just this generalized distress when they're in like social situations. And if a person has like the specific type, like performance anxiety where they have to give a speech or whatever, typically the drug of choice is propranolol, right? A non-selective beta blocker. Although remember, if a person has like really bad, like, bronchospastic disease, like really bad asthma, really bad reactive airway disease, you know, it's probably not a good idea to give those people a beta blocker, right? Because that can trigger a non-selective beta blocker like propranolol, because that can trigger their symptoms. Typically for those people, you can go ahead and give them a benzo, right? And in general, if a person has just chronic social anxiety disorder, not like, oh, they have to give a speech, but they just have like this pervasive fear of like social situations and everything, for the most part, you treat those people with CBT and SSRIs long-term, okay? CBT and SSRIs long-term. And then you also want to be able to recognize a panic attack on your exam, right? So, you know, typically how do panic attacks present, right? Like, you know, the person will have like these palpitations, sweating, they'll feel short of breath. They'll have a fear of like losing control, fear of like dying. They can even have chest pain. If they have chest pain, you want to make sure you get an EKG to make sure they're not like, you know, like having like an MI, right? You want to kind of rule that out. You know, they may have like abdominal pain. They may feel lightheaded. You may have all these like paresthesias. Basically, if you see that, that's a panic attack. And then if a patient keeps having all these things on a recurring basis, right, and they're happening like unexpectedly, and they are worried about getting like a future panic attack, that's panic disorder, okay? So panic disorder is just a person having recurring panic attacks, right? And the way you treat panic disorder, CBT and SSRIs, right? CBT and SSRIs, you need to start both together, right? So SSRIs are kind of like your first line for the most part. And again, when a person is having like an acute, like they're acutely symptomatic, right? You can actually just give them a benzo for the acute symptoms. But again, you obviously don't want to put them on a benzo long-term, right? That will not be a prudent thing to do on an NBMA exam. And then, so you can use it again if they're acutely symptomatic, you can kind of help them out there. But again, long-term benzo treatment for panic disorder, I promise you get that question wrong on your test. So don't do that, right? So now, one other thing I want to talk about is like, you know, like somatic symptom disorder, right? I think back in the day it was called somatization disorder. Basically, these people have like I like the term. The term is very descriptive, somatic symptom disorder. They literally have like one real somatic symptom, right? And it's usually not like a terrible somatic symptom, right? But the thing is, this somatic symptom then causes them a lot of distress in their lives, and they think about it a lot, they perseverate on it a lot. They have all these like, you know, like lifestyle behaviors all centered around the somatic symptom, right? And you know, once you see that, think about somatic symptom disorder. I mean, according to the DSM, they typically will have these symptoms for more than like 6 months. And one classic thing they may put on your exam is that this person has had like all these medical evaluations and they've all been negative, and usually you've tried reassuring them and it doesn't do squat, right? Essentially, if you see somatic symptom disorder on your test, the way you treat it is they should have like regular office appointments with one physician, not multiple physicians, right? Because if you go to a different physician may give you his own hot take, right? So I mean, like if you watch TV and you watch like Skip and Shannon, right? Like, or even all these sports shows, right? People always have their hot takes on things. And by the way, if you watch basketball shows, The Jump on ESPN is probably the best show in all of sports, but that's a different story for another day. But back to this, right? So basically, right, regular office appointments, regularly scheduled office appointments with one physician, okay? And then each time you see the patient, you just go ahead and reassure them that, you know, you've ruled out everything that's life-threatening, right? And, you know, you may maybe give them, like, some possible explanation for their symptoms, but always tell them, because again, they give all these behavioral questions on the family medicine shelf, just tell them that, you know, we've kind of ruled out of the life, all the life-threatening stuff, right? And again, you may also select CBT as actually like correct therapy for somatic symptom disorder on your exam, right? And then some mimics of somatic symptom disorder you want to watch out for on your exam, right? So if a person, you know, kind of like co-opts a physical symptom so that he can gain something like skip out on rotations or get out of jail or not have to appear in court, that's malingering on your test, right? Or if a patient, you know, so that's an example of a secondary gain, right? But if a person, you know, just loves that sick role, right? They love like the attention they get from being sick. They're not necessarily doing it to get anything. They're just doing it because it makes them feel good on the inside, right? For like their own internal economy, for a primary gain. Think about factitious disorder under those circumstances. And obviously, if a person is like, you know, like making other people have symptoms, like injecting poop into a person's bloodstream and all that badness, that's what was previously known as Munchausen's, right? These days on MBMEs, it's called a factitious disorder imposed on another, right? That's one thing to keep in mind. And then if a person's symptoms, you know, kind of revolve around the person having like abnormal motor symptoms or abnormal sensory symptoms, like, oh, like one limb is weak or whatever, right? And you're like, these symptoms don't seem to localize to any part of the brain, and it doesn't seem to be explained by any like medical condition, and the person doesn't seem to be super worried about those symptoms, right? And it's usually like super acute onset, especially like in a very young person, that, you know, you're like, this person shouldn't really be having strokes at this age. They want to think about conversion disorder under those circumstances, right? And then one key thing you want to be able to do on your test is being able to differentiate between like somatic symptom disorder and illness anxiety disorder. Illness anxiety disorder was the thing that back in the day people used to call a hypochondriasis. Basically, these people have like excessive worry, you know, about like their general health, and they're always worried, like they're always like super preoccupied with like health related activities. If you see that, think about illness anxiety disorder. So these people, they're just anxious about illness. They don't actually have like an actual symptom, right? So somatic symptom disorder, they have an actual symptom, they blow it out of proportion. People that have illness anxiety disorder, they have no symptoms, but they think they have problems, right? So that's the way to kind of keep those two things straight on an MBME exam. And then again, like I said in the USMLE and the military podcast, and obviously if you've not listened to that podcast and you're going to be taking like even your shelf exams or like step 2 CK, step 3 or step 1, you're just doing yourself a huge, huge, huge disservice, right? The thing is literally, I'm not telling you like secret information. It's literally in the USMLE like content outline that they are going to have an emphasized focus on geriatric-related questions and military-related questions. I've made a podcast on the military. I've made one podcast on geriatrics. And God willing, I'm going to make even more podcasts on geriatrics because there's some stuff I think I may want to talk about with like palliative care and stuff that's kind of high yield for the exam. You better listen to those podcasts. If you don't, I promise you, you will regret it on your exam. Again, I'm not saying this out of any like self-promotion. I'm literally saying this for like your own personal interest, right? So just something to keep in mind, right? And then another psych disorder you want to recognize on your exam, again, just kind of based off of the military, PTSD. I kind of talked about it nauseam in that military podcast. But basically, right, again, for family medicine shelf, PTSD, right? Like this person will have like some kind of history of trauma, right? Like they were in a major, like maybe it's a firefighter, a person that was like in the military in a war zone or whatever, and all their buddies were killed in battle or something like that, right? And then they keep re-experiencing those traumatic events, right? Like they keep having like all these flashbacks, and then they try to avoid any stimulus that may be associated with the trauma they experienced back in the day, right? And then they get like these, you know, like in like hyper arousal whenever they're exposed to this stimuli. You know, kind of think about that. Think about PTSD under those circumstances. And usually if a person actually has PTSD, you want to go ahead and screen them for like some comorbid psych disorders, right? And you also want to screen them for like being like abused at home, right? So those are just things you want to keep at the back of your mind. And really, for the most part, PTSD, you treat it with an SSRI, right? You can treat it with like citrulline paroxetine, but CBT is absolutely important. I'll say that again. CBT is absolutely important for people that have PTSD. And if a person has PTSD and they're having all these nightmares, prazosin is actually the drug of choice for the nightmares in PTSD. Now, here's one thing I'm going to tell you. Just, this is one of those like, almost like, oh, apple green by refringing some congruence thing. Whoever is listening to the this podcast, I am begging you, please, 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 never pick benzos as any kind of... Basically, if you have a PTSD question, benzos will be the wrong answer. Never, ever in your life pick benzos as treatment for any PTSD whatever, right? Benzos and PTSD, bad. If you do that on your test, I can pretty much, again, guarantee you, you will get the question wrong, right? Now... Let's kind of wrap this up real quick, right? So let's talk about OCD, right? Again, OCD, basically, look at the name, right? Obsessive compulsive disorder, right? Not obsessive compulsive personality disorder. That's a different psychiatric diagnosis. Here, I'm talking about OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. Basically, these people have one, they can either have the obsession or they can have the compulsion or they can have both. Right? And you don't need the compulsion. You just need the obsession to meet the diagnosis, right? So, but if you have both, I mean, obviously that's great, but yeah, you don't need both to make the diagnosis, right? So what is an obsession? An obsession is, you know, kind of like an intrusive thought, like a persistent idea, like a persistent impulse, or like images that kind of float around in a person's mind that, you know, they're typically like not ideal thoughts, right? And they cause like the person like big amounts of distress, big amounts of anxiety, right? And then compulsions are typically the things that you do to relieve the anxiety associated with the obsession, right? So they are like repetitive behaviors like washing your hands multiple times, checking something. I feel like the mantra of checking something multiple times is very pervasive on MBME exams, right? Or like keeping things in a certain order, or even sometimes it may not be like a physical act. It may be like a mental act, like counting something over and over again in their minds, or repeating something over and over again in their minds, like, you know, like a mental thing. That's actually a compulsion, right? And typically the people that have OCD, they recognize that what they are doing is unreasonable, right? They recognize it as like, wow, this thing is actually unreasonable, right? And for the most part, how do you treat OCD? Again, CBT. Right? CBT. And the CBT, occasionally they may ask for specifics on the exam. You may want to do things like exposure and response prevention, right? You expose them to the thing that triggers those intrusive thoughts and you kind of prevent them from responding to that stuff, right? And then you can treat it with an SSRI, right? You can also use clomipramine. Clomipramine is actually second line for treating a OCD. Or you can use olanzapine. And one mnemonic I teach people that I tutor all the time for OCD is like OCD, like literally the term OCD, right? Just read it backwards. The D for antidepressant, like an SSRI. The C for clomipramine, that's second line. The O for olanzapine, that's third line, right? But again, OCD, you always want to add CBT to those people's treatment regimen, right? And then don't forget your eating disorders. Please, folks, you got to know your eating disorders. They show up a lot on exams, right? So anorexia nervosa, the person's BMI will be less than 18.5. That's a given, right? And anorexia nervosa, right? Again, they'll, you know, either like vomit a ton, right? Or they restrict intake. They don't eat much food and all that stuff, right? So, you know, they'll have like a super low BMI. Again, don't forget the magic number 18.5. Usually these patients will have like this fear of gaining weight. They'll have like a distorted body image. They may actually have amenorrhea. And they may even give you an anorexia question and make it a risk factor question. Remember, people that have anorexia nervosa, they are at super high risk of osteoporosis, right? Because again, when you have low levels of estrogen, there's this mechanism I've described ad nauseum in many podcasts about like how estrogen increases the amount of osteoprotegrin, and osteoprotegrin kind of binds up RANK ligand. So RANK ligand does not interact with the RANK receptor and you don't have like leaching of bone, right? So again, if you're not eating much, you're not going to have reproductive potential. So your HPG axis will shut down. So your estrogen will go down and then the person is kind of screwed from that perspective, right? And then don't forget like bulimia, right? Don't forget bulimia. Bulimia, those people have normal weight or they'll be overweight. So their BMI will be above 18.5, right? Basically, if a person's BMI is not less than 18.5 on an MBME exam, they don't have anorexia nervosa. End of story. Okay, so their BMI will be more than 18.5. And typically people that have bulimia on MBME exams, they tend to have more of these compensatory behaviors, right? So they'll vomit, they'll use diuretics, they'll use laxatives, or they'll start fasting to lose weight, or they'll engage in like excessive amounts of exercise. Again, usually their BMI is In fact, I'll say I don't think I've ever seen a bulimia. Actually, it's not a matter of I don't think. I have never seen an NBME bulimia question where the person's BMI was not more than 18.5. Okay? That's very high you have to know. And again, I don't think I've ever seen an NBME question where a person had an anorexia nervosa and their BMI was not less than 18.5. Right? So again, just something to watch out for. And the thing is, on your NBMEs, they may actually try to integrate some other like medical disorders that are almost like complications of like these eating issues, right? So like they could have like really bad like dental disease, because remember, when acid kind of wears away, I think, your enamel, right? So you kind of get into trouble with like, you know, like dental caries and all that badness. You may see calluses on the dorsum of the fingers, that's like Russell's sign, or they may like kind of tear the esophagus, so they may have like a Mallory-Weiss tear. They may even have Brehaf syndrome from all the, again, all the MSS. They can have like all these electrolyte problems, right? So they love to give this thing. They may even give you like a question with arrows after describing a person with like anorexia or bulimia or whatever, right? Obviously, their chloride is going to be low, their potassium is going to be low, and they're going to have a metabolic alkalosis, right? And again, all these things should make sense. If you're puking stomach acid, you'll be hypochloremic because you're literally puking hydrochloric acid. And because you're puking acid, you get a metabolic alkalosis with that, right? But another reason you get a metabolic alkalosis is if you're a big puker, right? I don't think that's a real word, but anyhow, it's my podcast. I can do whatever I want. So, you know, if you're a big puker, right, you'll be volume down. If you're volume down, your preload will go down. If your preload goes down, your cardiac output will go in the toilet. And obviously, you'll stop perfusing your Afrin arterial appropriately. So your GG cells kind of freak out. They'll secrete a ton of renin. You convert angiotensinogen to angiotensin 1. That angiotensin 1 will travel to the lungs, the pulmonary capillaries, the endothelial cells will convert the angiotensin 1 to angiotensin 2. And in that angiotensin 2, will go to the zona glomerulosa of the adrenal cortex. You make a crap ton of aldosterone. And then that aldosterone will go to the principal cell of the collecting duct and spruce up that ENaC channel so that sodium is going in, potassium is being dumped in the urine, so you get a hypokalemia. And then the aldosterone will also go to the alpha intercalated cell and activate the proton pump that you find on the urine side. So you puke out protons in your urine as well, right? So you then get a contraction alkalosis with that, right? So that's something to keep at the back of your mind. And then the thing is, you want to be careful. Again, you want to know these complications of anorexia nervosa, for example, right? Like these people can get super anemic, they can get osteopenic, right? They can get osteoporosis, they can become profoundly hypotensive, they can have these electrolyte abnormalities already described, and they can also get like dangerous cardiac arrhythmias. In fact, dangerous cardiac arrhythmia is actually one of the most common causes of death in people that have anorexia nervosa, right? And the thing is, when you start feeding these people, and again, actually having anorexia and severe symptoms is actually an indication for involuntary hospitalization. That's something you want to watch out for your test. And again, when you start feeding these people, they're at very high risk for like repeating syndrome, right? So they can actually get like go into like a cardiac arrest, they can become delirious, right? And the thing that kills people in repeating syndrome is hypophosphatemia. That is a factor you want to burn into your brain forever, right? They can have hypophosphatemia, they can have hypokalemia. You may say, Divine, why does this happen and why does this kill? Well, let me explain. The thing is, if your body has not seen food for a long time, you're very hypoinsulinemic, right? But when your body starts seeing food again, your body has almost like this insulin rebound. And insulin loves to drive electrolytes into cells. So if it drives all your phosphate into cells, you can become profoundly hypophosphatemic. Then you will not have much ATP. And then you can go into cardiac arrest, right? And again, remember, insulin with glucose is one of the treatments for hyperkalemia, right? So it should make sense that hypokalemia should be an electrolyte finding in a person that's undergoing a refeeding syndrome, okay? So again, just kind of keep those at the back of your mind. And then for anorexia nervosa, for the most part, your first line treatment is CBT, okay? Drugs actually don't work for anorexia. I'll just tell you that right now. Drugs do not work for anorexia. Okay, I'll say that again. Drugs do not work for anorexia. CBT is the treatment of choice for anorexia nervosa, right? But the thing is, if a person has bulimia nervosa, right, you actually treat them with CBT and like an SSR, like antidepressants, right? So you can use like fluoxetine. Fluoxetine is probably going to be the correct answer on your test. And then there's this tricyclic known as imipramine. Imipramine is also ideal for people that have bulimia. But for the most part, fluoxetine is probably like the first thing you want to go with, because imipramine is a TCA. So obviously that's going to have some toxicity. And then one thing I want you to be able to differentiate on your test is between bulimia nervosa and binge eating disorder, right? Bulimia nervosa and binge eating disorder, the big difference is bulimia nervosa, those people eat a ton and they have compensatory behaviors. People that have binge eating disorder, they just binge eat, but they don't have any compensatory behaviors. They just feel like guilty as crap over what they're doing. That's the way you differentiate bulimia nervosa from binge eating disorder. And again, remember that those two disorders will have people that have BMIs greater than 18.5, but anorexia nervosa, the BMI will be less than 18.5. And again, if a person has any of these eating disorders, thou shalt not prescribe bupropion for those people. You give them bupropion, you get the answer wrong on your test, and I wouldn't want you to do that, right? And then again, I promise I'm almost done here. It's just, again, believe it or not, they test a fair amount of psych on this exam, so I just want this to be like that one podcast you listen to and you're like, okay, I feel like I can answer any psych question I see. Schizophrenia, I won't be able to recognize it, right? So again, these people that have schizophrenia, you know, they may have like weird illogical thoughts, disorganized speech, like their speech is kind of all over the place, so it's very like super incoherent. They have like disorganized behavior, or they may like stay in one position for prolonged periods. That's catatonia. These are all like positive symptoms of schizophrenia. Don't forget your negative symptoms, right? So flat affect, right? Like those people are almost like not responsive to the environment. There's this thing called alogia, right, where you ask them a question and they give you like these super concrete responses, or their speech is very like muted, they don't really talk much, you're not getting much from them, or they have like evolution where, you know, you're trying to like, it's almost like to get these people to initiate activity is just not there, right? You see all those things, those are negative symptoms. You see all these things in general, like I've described, that's schizophrenia. For the most part, schizophrenia, start them on an atypical first. So if they give you like haloperidol as an answer choice and they give you olanzapine, go with olanzapine, right? Go with an atypical antipsychotic first, like your olanzapine. Remember, that can cause metabolic syndrome. Risperidone, remember, that can cause hyperprolactinemia. Quetiapine, remember, that can cause cataracts, right? And remember, aripiprazole, right? You know, those are all second generation antipsychotics you can start with. And again, usually people that have schizophrenia, you want to go ahead and, you know, have them on board with a psychiatrist on an MMA exam. And then I think the final thing I'll talk about today, and I'll be done with this, is ADHD. ADHD usually kind of starts in a person's childhood. You know, they'll be inattentive. They'll be like super hyperactive in class, or they'll have like all these impulsive behaviors. And again, they'll have issues in two settings, right? The two settings are usually like two of three on MBME exams, either like at home, at work, or in school, right? And if a person has like a history of like substance abuse or some other mood disorder, they're at very high risk of having concomitant ADHD. And for the most part, the way you treat ADHD, you can use like a stimulant, right? Like you can use like methylphenidate, you can use amphetamine. But one thing that your friends writing these family medicine exams can try to do to you is they can tell you that, oh, this person has a history of hypertension or like bad cardiovascular disease. If a person has those issues, then, you know, it will not be a great idea to put them on like amphetamine or like methylphenidate. Well, the drug you should maybe consider under those circumstances is like atomoxetine. Atomoxetine is essentially an SNRI. So I'll spell that, it's A-T-O-M-O-X-E-T-I-N-E, atomoxetine. Right, so it's an SNRI. You can actually go ahead and use it for ADHD. In fact, it's becoming more and more common these days because it's not really a stimulant. Okay, it's not really a stimulant. I mean, you could also try CBT, but that's not something you'll likely see on your test. So I think I'm gonna go ahead and stop here. I feel pretty confident that if you listen to this podcast, any side question you see on your shelf, that'll be well, easily taken care of, God willing, right? So as I do at the end of every podcast, right? So I do offer one-on-one tutoring and large group tutoring for many exams, preclinical med school exams, third year shelf exams, step one, step two CK, step two CS. In fact, that's one thing I'm beginning to do more and more of, because for whatever reason, more and more people are beginning to fail step two CS for whatever reason. Step three, I tutor for that. If you're a medicine resident, I tutor for the internal medicine entry exam, the internal medicine shelf exams. The internal medicine ABIM board exam. And then, I offer these booster courses. It's 20 hours for step one and it's 15 hours for step two CK and step three. Yeah, 15 hours for step two CK and step three. And basically, it's basically like a course. I meet you one-on-one. We can meet like in 1 hour tranches or like in 2 hour tranches. And we just go over like most of the high yield stuff that's routinely tested on these exams, like the most knows for these exams in like a clinical vignette, rapid fire Q&A format. And then there's this thing I'm going to start doing, but I'm going to do it over Zoom in the future. So if you're interested in this, kind of let me know. I may have like sign-ups and I'll give like specific dates where this will happen. So this will all be online, where I will give like a very high yield review of something to like a group of like 30, 40, 50 people, right? It'll be like a very small fee per person, and we'll meet over Zoom, right? And I'll just kind of go through that material. And as we're going through those classes, I will kind of go over like test taking strategies and high yield things to keep in mind for exams with those things. So just kind of watch out for that. It's going to be the building in like in a few days, right? So just kind of be on the lookout for that. If you want to sign up, it'll be again a very small nominal fee for each of the people that attend. It will just be like a class literally, and it'll run for about an hour or 2 hours, but it'll be a very high yield rapid review of like a particular theme for a given exam. So if you're interested, again, just reach out to me and I'll give you some more information on that. And I'll probably make a podcast where I just kind of talk about what my idea is with that, right? And basically, one other thing I will say is if you're a med student applying to residency, so like an ERAS application, or a college student applying to med school, so like an AMCAS application, again, I do offer like one-on-one, I guess I'll call it consulting, like advising for like rec letters, personal statement editing, editing applications, doing mock interviews. Again, I've been on the admissions committee of a top 2 med school for like a year. So I've reviewed tons of high quality applications, and essentially the vast majority of the people I've worked with in these processes, they've pretty much all match their first choices. I have a pretty good track record actually with applications. So feel free to reach out to me. I'm very particular about things, right? Probably almost particular to a fault, but I actually do, thankfully, I feel like I do a pretty good job going through people's applications and preparing them for the residency process. Even if you have like a bad story, right? I can work with you and craft that story well to place you at an advantage, right? So again, if you need any of these things, or if you have a college body that needs student for like the MCAT or general chemistry, organic chemistry, physics, biochemistry, histology, physiology, just reach out to me. Either reach out to me through the website, or you can send me an email at Divine Intervention Podcasts with an S at the end. So DIVINEINTERVENTIONPODCASTS@gmail.com, right? And then I'll give you some more information. And then one other thing I'll go ahead and say is please subscribe to the YouTube channel. I want to hit 1,000 subscribers, hopefully before the end of the month. And please subscribe. This is all on Apple. It's on Spotify. It's on Google Play, all these podcasts. And then obviously there's the website where you can see the slides and everything, and also download the podcasts directly from there. Some people have asked me questions about like, oh, Divine, could you put like your earlier episodes on Apple or whatever? I'll have to figure that out, because I think Apple has like a limit on the number of podcasts you can place on their like on Apple Podcasts. Because right now, I mean, this is the 209th episode, right? So I will kind of try to figure that out and kind of go from there. If anyone has any ideas, feel free to reach out to me. I'm always receptive to ideas. So have a wonderful rest of your day. God bless you. And I will see you in the next podcast. Thank you.